Pilmates in the eastern region of the country. Meanwhile, a Libyan official travels to Greece for a meeting with that country's prime minister. In West Africa, Ivory Coast's incumbent president says he won't leave the country. Fighting between backers of rival candidates has claimed hundreds of lives. And demonstrations to take place tomorrow around the nation in support of Wisconsin public sector workers. I'm Anthony Fest. I'll have these stories and more on the KPFA Weekend News. Japan's Nuclear Safety Agency admitted today that it could take several months to bring the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant under control. The plant was badly damaged by the earthquake and tsunami that struck northeastern Japan on March 11th. More than 12,000 people are confirmed dead, and more than 15,000 others are still listed as missing. Today's statement by a Nuclear Safety Agency spokesman marked the first time that officials have offered a timeline for bringing the damaged nuclear reactors and fuel storage ponds under control. Today, emergency workers were still trying to seal a crack in a concrete pit that was allowing radioactive water to escape. The crack was discovered yesterday. The contaminated water could pose a danger to workers. There are six reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi site. Three were shut down for maintenance when the tsunami hit, but the other three were damaged after their cooling systems were knocked out. And there's also danger from the so-called spent fuel rods stored on site, which are still highly radioactive and need their own cooling to avert a meltdown. Arjan Makajani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, says the spent fuel rods stored in pools of water are likely to pose a greater hazard for cleanup workers than are the damaged reactors themselves.
I don't know how they're going to suppress the spent fuel pool emissions because the buildings are destroyed. And you have to have some way to channel the contaminated air or steam and filter it. So in that case, you can actually catch some of these. But you can't build anything right now because the environment near the spent fuel pools is extremely radioactive. And the three or the four buildings in question, their structures are substantially destroyed where the spent fuel pools are. So I think this problem is going to continue for 4 months, and I don't see any obvious way to fix the pool problem. The reactors, if they can establish the regular cooling systems, you know, with the pumps, and carry away the heat in some systematic way, then, and if the containment vessels are intact, which in reactor number two it may not be, then that may be less worrisome than the spent fuel pool.
Makajani says people in the U.S. should also be very concerned about spent fuel stored at nuclear power plants, because there's a lot of it at some U.S. plants.
Vermont Yankee's spent fuel pool, same reactor, Mark 1, about 40 years old, just like Unit 1, is due to be closed down next year by the action of the Senate. In the middle of this crisis, the NRC issued a 20-year license extension without waiting for a deep breath and without ordering the utility to empty the spent fuel pool as much as possible. That spent fuel pool has more spent fuel in it than all four of the Fukushima spent fuel pools put together.
In the early days of the disaster, the Japanese government and the utility that owns the plant came under heavy criticism for not reacting quickly enough given the scope of the emergency. Jackie Cabasso with the Western States Legal Foundation says many people near the site of the disaster still are being left without much help.
There are just some heart-wrenching appeals coming out and testimonials. There's one mayor, the mayor of Minamisoma in Fukushima Prefecture, who's in that zone between the 20 and 30 kilometer radius, which is the shelter-in-place zone. And he did an 11-minute appeal in English on YouTube asking for international help because he says they're not getting the information they need. Food delivery services and so on are unwilling to come into the zone because they're frightened. People can't get transportation out of the zone, so they're facing food shortages, and they don't know whether they should stay or evacuate. If they want to evacuate, they can't. I mean, things like that.
Jackie Cabasso and Arjan Makajani spoke this morning on the KPFA Sunday show. California has two operating nuclear power plants, San Onofre in Orange County and PG&E's Diablo Canyon plant in San Luis Obispo County on the Central Coast. Both are on the coastline and both are built near earthquake faults. State Senator Alex Padilla has called for a special hearing at the state capitol on April 14th to examine the risks the two aging plants might pose. KPFA's Ann Garrison has the story.
For the past 5 years, the San Luis Obispo-based Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility has been urging California legislators and oversight agencies to require peer-reviewed seismic studies to measure the risk of earthquake damage to Pacific Gas and Electric's nuclear power plant at Diablo Canyon and Southern California Edison's plant at San Onofre. The California Energy Commission has requested that the California Public Utilities Commission require PG&E to do the latest advanced 3D studies on both old and new earthquake faults beneath Diablo Canyon before granting any ratepayer funding for its license renewal applications. But PG&E has opposed and fought the requirement to do the studies, and the CPUC has failed to act. Rochelle Becker, executive director of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, says that Japan's worsening nuclear catastrophe could have been California's, and that Californians should be able to insist that the studies be done now.
The one thing that separates California from every other reactor site in the nation is the seismic proximity. There are 4 active faults within 5 kilometers of Diablo Canyon, 1,800 feet away. There are several active faults offshore of San Onofre, and there are new studies being done that have come out of the Baja quakes last year. We are focusing on what the state has jurisdiction to do. If we step into fighting nuclear power, fighting the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, then we have a much greater hill to climb. And we are on the other side of the country from the rest of the reactors groups. We need to focus on California. We certainly support what everybody else is doing, but in California, it's California rights that should do this. It is California elected officials who are responsible.
Updates on the challenge to relicensing California's nuclear power plants will be posted to the website of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, A4NR.org, as the process unfolds. For Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
In Pakistan today, a pair of Taliban suicide bombers struck one of the nation's most important Sufi Muslim shrines, killing 42 people and wounding 100. Those in the shrine were celebrating the anniversary of its founder's death with music, meditation, and other practices abhorred by fundamentalist Sunni militant groups. Another bomber was wounded when his explosive vest partially detonated. He was arrested, along with a 4th militant who was seized before attacking, this according to a police official. The attack on the Sakhi Sarwar Shrine ended a months-long respite in a campaign against the shrines founded by ancient adherents of Sufism, a mystical branch of Islam that sees dancing, chanting, and visiting holy sites as expressions of devotion to God. A Taliban spokesman called the Associated Press to claim responsibility for the attack. 19 men, 14 women, and 9 children were killed, this according to an emergency official. 20 of the wounded were in critical condition. Kamal Haider reports from Islamabad.
A deadly attack on a Sufi shrine leaves at least 40 people dead and wounds up to another 100. Now that attack taking place at least 40 kilometers away from the main town of Dera Ghazi Khan. Rescue efforts were underway in that particular area. The people were moved to hospitals in Dera Ghazi Khan. Therefore, the death toll mounting. Now, according to the reports, at least 3 suicide bombers entered the shrine from the back entrance, therefore avoiding the security cordon that was set up on the front. At least 2 of them are then said to have detonated their explosives with deadly results, and one of them is said to have been arrested by the security forces. Now, the Pakistani Taliban have taken responsibility for this attack. They have attacked shrines in the past, but they have also attacked funeral prayers and even congregational prayers at mosques.
And that report from Al Jazeera's Kamal Haider in Islamabad, Pakistan. Turning now to news from Africa, a spokesman for Ivory Coast's incumbent president says he'll refuse any offers to go into exile. The United Nations and international observers say Laurent Gbagbo lost a bid for re-election last November and that competing candidate Alassane Ouattara is now the rightful president of the West African nation. But Gbagbo says he's staying in office and the confrontation has become a bloody one, with battles taking place between the two candidates' forces. The Catholic charity organization Caritas says 1,000 people may have died in a single town. Al Jazeera's Gerald Tan reports from Abidjan, the Ivorian capital city.
Keeping watch over a combat zone, UN helicopters patrolling the skies of a Cote d'Ivoire's financial hub and seat of power. The fight for Abidjan is now in its fourth ferocious day. On the streets, residents are beginning to venture out in fear, but out of sheer necessity.
We have nothing left to eat at home. I only have one fish left in the fridge, and after that, I don't know what I'll do.
There are many things that we don't have anymore. Rice, bananas, many things, vegetables, because they don't get here anymore.
Abidjan is witnessing a final showdown, capping off a bloody presidential battle sparked by last November's disputed elections. Forces loyal to the internationally recognized winner Alassane Ouattara say they aim to dislodge incumbent leader Laurent Gbagbo once and for all. Fighting is said to be centered around the key institutions of influence, the presidential palace, military bases, and the state TV building. But Abidjan's main airport, now controlled by the French. Overnight into Sunday, hundreds of young people began descending on the city, apparently heeding the Gbagbo government's call for a human shield around his home and offices. Already, a million civilians are estimated to have fled the violence in Abidjan. France has been helping move foreign nationals to a camp outside the city. And the United Nations has issued an evacuation order for 200 of its remaining so-called essential employees, non-essential staff left months ago. The UN has been criticized for failing to protect civilians in the town of Duakoi. An estimated 1,000 people were killed there last week by fighters from both camps. It constituted the worst recorded atrocity of the Ivorian crisis so far. Gerald Tan, Al Jazeera.
Elsewhere in West Africa, Nigeria postponed parliamentary and presidential elections by 1 week after failing to get logistics prepared in time, a major embarrassment for a nation hoping to break with a history of chaotic polls. Africa's most populous country will now hold parliamentary elections on April 9th, presidential elections on April 16th, and governorship elections in its 36 states on April 26th. This according to an announcement today from the Electoral Commission. Nigeria was forced to cancel the parliamentary elections set for yesterday after voting materials failed to arrive on time in many parts of the country. It had planned to try again tomorrow, but political parties claimed the time frame was too tight. In North Africa, reports from Libya today say a military stalemate is developing between the army and rebel forces in the east, with neither side able to prevail, this despite the intervention of U.S. and NATO air forces on the side of the rebels. The rebels hope to oust longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi. The BBC and the Reuters news agency report that the army and the rebels are deadlocked. But also today, a Libyan official traveled to Greece to meet with the country's prime minister in what might be an effort to craft a diplomatic end to the confrontation. Al Jazeera correspondent Anita McNaught in Tripoli says the Greek government has long had good relations with Gaddafi.
Colonel Gaddafi's relationship with George Papandreou, the Prime Minister's father, was a very sound and solid one. And perhaps it is because in recent weeks, Greece has lent a more sympathetic ear to Colonel Gaddafi than some of his former allies, like Italy, who in the end upset Colonel Gaddafi very much by offering help to the military alliance against him with offers of air bases and air support and that sort of thing. And also countries like Turkey, which while it's been very fair on the issue of how NATO should conduct itself, has also proved itself to be very fair in not being pushed around by Libya. For example, Turkey has just extracted a couple of hundred wounded people from the city of Misrata despite being told by Gaddafi's government that the ship Turkey was sending was not to go to Misrata but to stay in Tripoli until it decided it wanted it sent there. The Turks went there straight away with a military escort. So although the Turks themselves have offered themselves as mediators, perhaps they're not as sympathetic as Colonel Gaddafi would like, hence the reason why Greece has been singled out for this. But until we actually know what the content of that message is, and maybe, and of course this is part of the speculation now, is he going to request from Greece that they play a role in some kind of safe passage for him out of the country? That, the Greek government is saying, is absolutely not what has been discussed up till now. But that, of course, is not completely outside the realms of possibility, except for the fact that all the sources we have here in Libya say that neither Colonel Gaddafi nor his sons are interested in considering anything that involves any of them leaving Libya at all.
And that's Al Jazeera correspondent Anita McNaught in Tripoli. Egypt's military council has denied an Al Jazeera report that former President Hosni Mubarak had left the country for Germany. Asked whether Mubarak had left Egypt, a source from the military council told the Reuters news agency, quote, "No, this is denied." Mubarak had been staying in a Red Sea resort town since being ousted from office on February 11th by a popular uprising. The military council said this week that Mubarak and his family were banned from leaving the country. This is KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley or KFCF in Fresno, Pacifica Radio for Northern and Central California. This program is the Weekend News. I'm Anthony Fest. And tomorrow on the Morning Mix, KPFA's Interim General Manager Andrew Phillips will be on the air to discuss the state of the station and to take questions from listeners. Tune into the Morning Mix Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 a.m. Thousands of Syrians marched through a Damascus suburb today in funeral processions for demonstrators killed on Friday during anti-government protests. The march took place in Douma, the same location where the protesters were killed. Local activists say the demonstrators were killed by security forces, while the government blamed Friday's violence on what it called armed thugs. At least 10 people were killed on Friday, according to human rights organizations. At least 80 have died since the protests in Syria began last month. The crowds chanted, "We want freedom," and a witness told the Associated Press, quote, "It looks like all of Douma is out in the streets today." Also today, longtime government critic Suher Atassi was released. He'd been arrested just over 2 weeks ago during demonstrations in front of the Interior Ministry. But human rights groups say arrests of other activists were continuing today. In other developments in Syria, President Bashar Assad announced his choice of a new prime minister. Assad appointed Adel Safar to form a new cabinet. Safar is a former agriculture minister. Earlier this week, Assad dismissed the entire cabinet, but reform advocates want Assad himself to step down. Bashar Assad has been president since 2000. He took office on the death of his father, Hafez Assad, who had ruled the country since 1971. And turning now to domestic news, workers across the country are preparing for a National Day of Action tomorrow, in solidarity with Wisconsin public sector workers and all workers facing attacks. Tomorrow was also the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, who was killed while speaking out against economic injustice in Memphis, Tennessee. According to MoveOn.org, over 1,000 rallies, actions, and teach-ins have already been planned. For more, here's KPFA's Lucas Gilkey.
In cities and towns across the country, people will rally tomorrow in support of workers' rights and against the efforts of Republicans to take away collective bargaining of public sector employees. William Scott is a PhD student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as well as a member of the local Teachers Assistant Union. He is helping to organize a Poor People's March that will feed into the larger demonstration in Madison, where Jesse Jackson and local labor leaders will speak.
Martin Luther King, towards the end of his career, had begun associating civil rights directly with labor rights, and we want to reemphasize that in the narrative of Martin Luther King. Labor rights equals civil rights.
In Wisconsin, local organizers are currently gathering signatures to recall the Republican state senators who passed the anti-union bill. They have filed for the recall of one senator and expect to have enough signatures to file for the recall of three more senators in the next week and a half. The bill is currently under a restraining order for an undetermined amount of time because legislators passed it in violation of open minutes laws. On Tuesday, April 5th, the Wisconsin public will vote on Supreme Court justices, who could end up playing an important role in Wisconsin's labor struggles if the bill ends up going through the courts. In Oakland tomorrow, teachers will be demanding a halt to the 538 pink slips delivered in March, threatening the jobs of close to one-third of Oakland's teachers. From 7 to 8 a.m., teachers will be on street corners near their schools, making noise and bringing attention to their layoff notices. At 10:30, they plan to sit in and picket at the Wells Fargo Bank on 12th and Broadway, as well as holding a teach-in on the bank bailouts. Craig Gordon is a high school teacher in Oakland and also on the executive board of the Oakland Education Association, the local teachers union.
The reason why we're going to the banks and to Wells Fargo as a locally based bank is because we believe that, you know, the politicians will continue to claim that they don't have, that their hands are tied and that they don't have the power to do anything because the money isn't there. And we know that the money is in the banks, and we also know that the banks have tremendous power because they were powerful enough to demand trillions to save themselves for their own irresponsible policies. We think that that kind of public pressure will force them eventually to possibly go to the policymakers in government and say, why don't you do something, make this go away.
At noon, the AFL-CIO, other local unions, and their allies will rally at Frank Ogawa Plaza. Jack Heyman is a longtime longshore union activist.
I think we're reaching a point in this country where the right wing has turned the clock back so far that we're facing conditions that we did over 100 years ago, where actually unions were illegal at one point in this country. So really the pendulum has swung back so far that there needs to be an action to start moving the momentum in the other direction for social justice.
For more information on National Day of Action events across the country, visit the website we-r-1.org. That's we-r-1.org. For KPFA, this is Lucas Gilkey in Berkeley.
And there are many actions taking place around Northern California tomorrow. Again, that Oakland rally happening just before 12 noon at Frank Ogawa Plaza in downtown Oakland. Here are a few others. In Novato, there'll be a rally at 3:30 at the Unified School District office at 7th and Grant. In San Francisco, at 5 o'clock, there'll be a rally at the Bank of America building, 555 California Street in the Financial District, followed by a march to the Federal Reserve building at 101 Market. And in San Jose, there'll be a rally beginning at 5:30. The location is 100 Paseo de San Antonio. Labor statistics released on Friday indicated that the unemployment rate for last month was at its lowest level in 2 years. But also on Friday, the organization Wider Opportunities for Women released a report that called into question the quality of the jobs recently added. The report finds that jobs created in the coming years will not provide economic security to the majority of U.S. workers who don't have four-year college degrees. Fewer than 13% of jobs the U.S. Labor Department expects to be created by the year 2018 are likely to provide economic security to a single parent raising two or more children. This according to the study. It says about 43% of the new jobs will pay economic security wages for two workers raising two children. A small majority of the new jobs will pay economic security wages to single workers with no children. The full report is available at www.wowonline.org. Renowned African-American historian Manning Marable died this week. He died on Friday, a few days before his latest book was slated for publication. The cause of death is not known, but Marable had been hospitalized with pneumonia last month and had a double lung transplant last summer. KPFA reporter Marie Che has the story.
Manning Marable died on Friday at the age of 60, just days before the publication of his new book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Marable had been a professor of public affairs, political science, history, and African American studies at Columbia University for 15 years and director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies for 10. As a public intellectual, he wrote hundreds of articles and books on the political history of African Americans and has published a regular column called Along the Color Line since 1976. Through his columns, he engaged with the public debates of his time, taking on issues of race, class, militarism, American imperialism, and global capitalism. In his latest book, Marable provides a more comprehensive view of Malcolm X's life and politics. In a 2007 interview with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, Marable explained that Alex Haley's autobiography of Malcolm X incorrectly portrayed Malcolm as an evolving integrationist. According to Marable, Malcolm was a dedicated black nationalist and the forerunner who charted out a path for other black leaders of his time.
Malcolm was the first prominent African-American, arguably the first prominent American leader, to come out against the Vietnam War. It was Malcolm X who said that we had to go beyond civil rights to human rights. 3 years later, it was Dr. King that followed out a path that Malcolm had clearly charted for him, so that the internationalization and the Pan-Africanism of Malcolm, all of that forms the foundation of what becomes black power and Pan-Africanism of Stokely Carmichael and the Black Panther Party 3-4 years later.
In his interview with Goodman, Marable also critiqued the lack of a black political agenda today and stressed the need for a strong black left.
Where is the black political agenda for 2008? It's radically disappearing. The Congressional Black Caucus from 15 years ago was an assertive, independent voice for change. Where is that voice today? The NAACP, the Urban League, civil rights organizations are now corporatized. They either reach into the ranks of corporate America to find its leadership, or they're funded by corporations. And so without an effective, articulate, democratic left voice in this country, the liberals will never be accountable to even their own politics.
Marable's last book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, will be released tomorrow. Marable is survived by his wife and 5 children. For KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Marie Che.
Most of Mexico's largest news media outlets have agreed to a set of drug war reporting guidelines, promising not to glorify drug traffickers, publish cartel propaganda, or reveal information that could endanger police. Shannon Young reports.
Some hail it as a necessary code of ethics for a press that often sensationalizes drug cartels and the violence that surrounds them. But critics condemn the code for further restricting a press that already practices a significant amount of self-censorship. Among the rules are the requirements that reporters take a position against violence perpetrated by organized crime, not allow themselves to become, quote, involuntary spokespersons for the cartels, and not interfere in the combat against crime by publishing information that could put an investigation or operation at risk. There are also guidelines for journalists in danger, allowing them to file stories anonymously and to not produce live reports from an area deemed violent. Only 4 major national media outlets have not signed on to the pact, but they may face pressure to conform to the new guidelines. Mexican senators have indicated they'll move a proposal as early as next week to make the voluntary reporting guidelines law. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
And here are tonight's community announcements. Tuesday evening in San Francisco, there'll be a panel discussion about isolation units in prisons. This event will take place at the Women's Building, 3543 18th Street, beginning at 6:30. It's being presented by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Tuesday evening in Palo Alto will be the start of a 4-session series of weekly seminars about nuclear disarmament. They'll take place at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 505 East Charleston Road, over the next 4 Tuesdays. Each one begins at 7 o'clock. Saturday and Sunday in San Francisco will be the annual Bay Area Anarchist Book Fair. It's taking place at the County Fair Building in Golden Gate Park. That's near 9th and Lincoln in the Inner Sunset neighborhood. 5 Muni lines pass within 2 blocks, the N. Judah streetcar and the 6, 43, 44, and 71 buses. Saturday evening in San Francisco, there'll be a speech by Afghan human rights advocate Malalai Joya, who's on a U.S. speaking tour. Joya will be speaking at the Episcopal Church of St. John the Evangelist, 1661 15th Street in the Mission District, beginning at 7 o'clock. Sunday in San Francisco is the Rally Against Wars at Home and Abroad. The rally begins at 12 noon at Dolores Park, and a march from there to the Civic Center will begin at 1:30. Sunday's rally is being organized by the United National Anti-War Committee. For more information, see www.unacpeace.org. And Sunday afternoon in Berkeley, 3 anti-nuclear campaigners from Russia will be speaking at the Unitarian Universalist Hall. One of them was a cleanup engineer at the site of the Chernobyl disaster. This event begins at 4 o'clock. The UU Hall is at 1924 Cedar Street. The weather for the Bay Area, clear with lows in the 40s tonight. Tomorrow, sunny, highs from the 60s to the 70s. Tomorrow in Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley, clear tonight, lows in the 40s. Tomorrow in the valley, clear, highs from 75 to 80. That concludes the weekend news for Sunday, April 3rd. Thanks for tuning in. Please stay tuned for the Radio Chronicles. Our reporters tonight were Lucas Gilkey, Marie Che, and Ann Garrison. Our engineer is Veronica Faison, and I'm Anthony Fest. Good evening.